Got a picture of W5. I don't know if you've ever been to W5. It's in Belfast. It's in what is now known as the Titanic Quarter, a groovy name. And it's kind of a place to ask questions. I don't know if there was somewhere like this in Dublin or this kind of area, but it's a kind of place where young people and children can go to and get their hands on scientific-y things and ask those five questions: who, what, why, when, and where, or a combination of those. And questions are really good because that's how we learn, asking questions. And the story we're looking at today began with a question, as many of these stories do. Someone would ask Jesus a question. And it was a lawyer who stood up to ask a question. But not a lawyer as we think of as in a court scene defending somebody, but this was an expert in the law of God. So someone who knew the Old Testament inside out, who devoted his life to it, who studied it, he was an expert in it. Jesus is teaching, people are sitting, a man stands up, the lawyer, to ask a question. And he begins very, very well. He says, "Teacher," which is a little fly around here, "Teacher." But he's not going to ask a question as though he's a student. He's not asking a question for information or for clarification. Luke tells us that he asks a question to test Jesus. As many people did, time and again, people would come to test Jesus, to trip him up, to see if he was orthodox, to see if he believed what we believe, do what we do. But many people didn't like him and wanted to trip him up. And this was a question to test him. What must I do to inherit eternal life? I would love it if people came to me and said, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" It's a great question, isn't it? Because I could tell them the gospel. Well, Jesus came from heaven to earth. He died on a cross for our sin. When we put our trust in him, we will have eternal life. Wouldn't that be a great question? And yet, right at the heart of this question, there's an assumption that you can do something to inherit eternal life. But inheritance doesn't work like that, does it? Inheritance is not about what you do, but about who you are. So your children will inherit, your grandchildren will inherit, or some good friend. But it's not about what you do, it's about who you are. But Jesus doesn't dismiss his question. Instead, Jesus asks him a question. "Well, you're an expert in the law. What does the law have to say on this question? How do you read it?" So the man came back with a perfect answer. "Well, the law says to love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love your neighbor as you love yourself." And that was a brilliant answer, because that is exactly the answer Jesus gave to another question, which was, "What is the greatest commandment? Out of all these commands in this book, many, 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 which is the greatest?" Jesus was asked, and he came up with that solution. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength." And the second one's like it. "Love your neighbor as yourself." So this was a brilliant answer that the lawyer gave. And what did Jesus say? "You're absolutely right. Do this and you will inherit eternal life. You will live." So was Jesus saying that you can do something to inherit eternal life? Well, in a sense, yes, he was. Because if you can do that, then you don't need grace. But we have to understand what the standard we have to meet is. It's to love God perfectly, with all our hearts, all our souls, all our mind, all our strength. With everything we are, we have to love him. And with our neighbor, it has to be perfect love. A bit like we love ourselves, what we do for ourselves, we would do for another. And as Paul says in Romans, the problem isn't the law. The problem is, we can't keep it. It's impossible. We're weak, we're frail, we're sinful. So the problem isn't the law. The problem is that we just can't do it. So that could have been the end of the conversation. But the text says that the lawyer was seeking to justify himself. So that's an interesting line, isn't it? Interesting words. Seeking to justify himself. And this is a kind of underlying theme in the whole of the book of Luke, where people are trying to justify themselves. Self-justification. Like the two men who were praying, and Jesus said, look, one man looks really holy, and he says, Lord, look at me. Thank you that you didn't make me like these sinners. I'm just fabulous. And the other man lay down, and he said, God, forgive me, a poor sinner. I can't do anything right. And he said, this man went away justified. So it's not about self-justification. It's about how God can justify us. But he's saying, the lawyer comes back and says, well, who is my neighbor to try and justify himself? And he's looking for a list, because we like lists, don't we? We like to have boundaries. What does this mean? You have to love your neighbor as you love yourself. So who is my neighbor? Give me a list. Give me a boundary. Does that mean my children, my spouse, my closest family? Does that mean the people who live within half a kilometer of me? Does that mean people of my religion? Does that mean an Israelite? What does that look like? And we're always trying to set boundaries, and Jesus is always trying to blow up those boundaries. So the rabbis might say, holy people like us should hang out with holy people like us. We don't want to mix with sinners and tax collectors and all those dirty people. And Jesus would explode that, because he loved hanging out with sinners and tax collectors. He loved them. He ate with them. That's why the other goody-goodies didn't really like Jesus too much. Or they would say, there are lots of rules, and one of the rules is you can't heal on the Sabbath. Bang! Jesus would heal on the Sabbath, and he said, but the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And even last week when we were thinking about forgiveness, didn't Peter come to Jesus and said, how many times must I forgive my brother? Twice? Three times? Four times? Seven times? Where is the boundary? And Jesus said, there is no boundary. It's limitless, because that's how God forgives us. There is no limit. When we think about our commitment to church, or when we give our offering to church, how much do I have to give? Is it a tithe? Is it 10%? Well, that's a pretty good start, but if you look at the Old Testament, it kind of suggests maybe closer to 40%. Gosh, so hang on, that's a lot, isn't it? Or in the New Testament, Jesus saw a lady who gave two small pennies and put it in the collection, and he commended her for it, but it was everything she had. So where's the boundaries? We keep trying to put boundaries on things, and Jesus keeps blowing these boundaries up. He doesn't want them to exist, because that's not the way he treats us. So Jesus tells them a story that was going to blow their minds. We know the story really well, probably. Maybe we know it too well. And as I said last week, these stories would have had a shock value to the people listening. So I want you to kind of hear it as though you were the first listeners. Because Jesus was going to take this question that the lawyer gave him, and he was going to unwrap it. And then he was going to repackage it and hand it back to him in a different way. And it was going to blow his mind. It was going to shock him. And the story is of a man who's traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. This is the road. It's 17 miles long. It descends 3,000 feet. It's a dangerous and difficult road. If you were going to be mugged, it would be on this road. People generally traveled in groups. People didn't travel on their own because it's a scary road to travel. This is the road that Jesus described. The man's coming down, and the inevitable happened. The robbers came, they beat him up, they stole everything he had, they stripped him naked, and they beat him to the point of death. And a priest comes along. Now, if anyone would know about the law of God and loving your neighbor, it would be this priest, wouldn't it? But he didn't stop. He passed by on the other side. Why did he do that? Maybe he thought the bandits were still there. They'll beat me up. They'll leave me half dead. They'll steal everything I have. Better keep moving. Or maybe because he was a priest, he didn't want to go near the man because he might have thought the man was dead. And if he had gone near him or touched him, he would have been ceremonially unclean, which meant he would have had to go back to Jerusalem and spend the next 7 days becoming ceremonially clean again. So it had implications for him, for his family that he was going to, and for his job. It was very inconvenient. Maybe all these things were going through his mind. We don't know when through went through in his mind, but we do know he did not stop. Second man came along, a Levite. He was a holy man as well. Levites had many duties in the temple to do, like an assistant to the priest. If anyone was going to know the laws of God, it would be that Levite. Love God. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. But he passed by on the other side. Why did he do that? Maybe the same kind of reasoning. Who knows? What would you have done? On this scary road. And you've got somewhere to go. People are depending on you. What would you have done? During the week, I was watching some stuff on the internet, and there was a social experiment done where a man dressed up as a homeless person. And as he walked through the crowd, suddenly he collapsed. I think I've got a picture. Yes, that one. Yeah, that's actually open. The man collapses in the street. How many people do you think ran to his aid? None. He did it on several locations. Same result everywhere he went. He then dressed up as a businessman, respectable looking. He did the same again. This time people came to him. What does that say about us? The thing about this man, he was stripped naked and he was unconscious. If you had spoken to him, you might have been able to tell who he was or where he was from. Is he a friend or a foe? Was he like me? If he had been wearing clothes, you would have seen the kind of person that he was, what tribe he came from. You know, is he a Jew? Is he a Samaritan? Is he? Because there were many, many different people traveled that road. But this man had nothing to identify him. Maybe that was the point. There was nothing to say who he was. But what would you have done if you'd have been there? The audience are hanging on every word of Jesus because they probably think what's going to happen next. So they had the priest coming, really holy person. They had the Levite going, kind of holy person. Well, surely the next person going to come along is an ordinary Jew, just a layman who sits in the pews. And he's going to save the day and he's going to be a hero. We know what's going to happen. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. Now, if you could hear that in the way that Jesus' audience would have heard that, it would have been shocking. Because the Jews hated the Samaritans, and the Samaritans hated the Jews. And it all began 500 or 600 years before that, whenever the big nation of Assyria came, and they knocked the kind of northern tribes of Israel on the head, and they took many people away, and they left many people. But they always took the best people to kind of decapitate the nation, take their cleverest and most radical away. But then what they would do would be to send some of the other defeated places from other areas in to fill the gap. And the people of Samaria, the Jews of Samaria, intermarried with other people. And so the real Jews hated the Samaritans because they weren't really Jews. They had intermarried. They didn't really obey the law like they obeyed the law. The hate was very, very great. Intense. Maybe we could tell the story a different way. Maybe it could be the man was lying there half dead and along comes the Pope on his donkey. And he doesn't stop. And then along comes the moderator of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. And he passes by on the other side. And then maybe a Muslim cleric came along. Or an ISIS terrorist came along. And when he saw him, he had compassion for him. And he stopped. But the Samaritan stops. He goes to the man, he tends his wounds. With wine, he cleanses his wounds. With oil, he soothes his wounds. He bandages them up. He takes him, he sets him on his own donkey, which meant the Samaritan was going to have to walk, and he took him to an inn. wherever before that was. He stayed with them the night to look after him. The next morning when he was going on his way, he said to the innkeeper, "Here's some money, that will look after him for a week or two. I'm coming back. If it costs any more than this to take care of him, I will refund you. I will pay whatever it takes." That was really important that he said that he would pay whatever it takes, because if that man had been left in a condition where he couldn't have taken care of himself and he got into debt, the innkeeper could have sold the man as a slave. He was perfectly entitled to. But no, the Samaritan says, "Whatever he owes you, I will pay." And isn't that a beautiful picture of what Jesus has done for us? Isn't he the one that has come to us and tended our wounds and picked us up and looked after us and paid the price that we could not pay? And whatever it would take, he would pay it, and he did, with his life. Didn't Jesus look on us with pity, with compassion? Didn't Jesus stop? We call this story the story of the Good Samaritan. Why do we do that? Jesus doesn't call him a Good Samaritan. Nowhere in the text does it describe the story as a Good Samaritan. Why do we use the word good? Is it because our standards are so low? I was reading a book and a man was talking about his friend who was talking about the wonderful elders he had in the church. I've got a really good elder. What do you mean you've got a really good elder? Well, he comes to all the meetings, he tithes, he supports me in any way he can. Well, that's not a good elder, that's just an elder. Take note. But isn't that the case? Why do we call him good? Isn't this the response that should be natural? We shouldn't be elevated because you stopped to help somebody who's dying. Why do we call him good? But with this question, Jesus has unwrapped it and now he repackages it with a final question of his own. He says to the lawyer, "Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" Which of these three do you think acted like a neighbor? And the lawyer couldn't even bring himself to say the word Samaritan. So he says, "Well, I suppose the one who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said, "That's right. You go and you live like that." So it wasn't a question of who is my neighbor, but the question was, who must I become a neighbor to? Because the man lying down wasn't the neighbor. It was the Samaritan who was the neighbor. Which of these acted like a good neighbor? So not who is my neighbor, but to whom must I become a neighbor? And the answer is anyone who is in need. Anyone who is in need. Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, "Therefore, as we have opportunity, let's do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers." So what does it mean to be a neighbor in this church? For the people sitting around us, and lots of good things happen here. What does it mean to be a neighbor to our community? We reach out in various ways, don't we? What does it mean to be a neighbor to the wider world? In our world, there are many needs. There are many opportunities to act like a neighbor. Because God still cares about the hungry, that they should be fed, about the homeless, that they should have a home to live in. He cares about those who are fleeing from war-torn areas and persecution. He cares about all these things. How do we be a neighbor to all these people? But the greatest need, as I try to say to the boys and girls, for the whole world, is to meet the most basic need that humanity has. And it's not food, and it's not shelter, it's not safety. It's forgiveness and restoration. through the cross of Jesus Christ. And that's how we can be, as a church, as a Christian, as a community, be a neighbor. To fulfill this greatest need. To tell people of what Jesus has done. Because our world, our society, is lying naked and dying on a road. That's the picture of our world. Are we going to pass by? Maybe inconvenient, costly, demanding. But what are we going to do to be a neighbor? My installation, I was really glad when my brother came. My brother isn't getting any younger because he's much older than I. And his wife hasn't been well for a long time. He's her chief carer, really. And he lives in the south of England, so when he said he was coming, I was really shocked, I surprised. I didn't expect him to come. But I was delighted when he did come. And why did he come? Well, he came because he loved me. And isn't this where we came in? To love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love your neighbor like you love yourself, because we can't love our neighbor if we don't love God, if we haven't got his love in our heart. Because this is too big. This is too difficult. This is too divine. But if we love God and we strive to, then we will love the people that he loves in the way that he loves them. And we will step out of our comfort zone. And it will be costly and it will be inconvenient. But that's okay, because we're doing what Jesus has done and what he would do. We're commanded to love. Love is the oxygen of the kingdom. We cannot live in his kingdom without it. And we don't have to.